Well, hi, this is Joel McIver, and you're listening to Focus on Metal. Focus on Metal!
Hey, Metalheads, Scott
and Richie.
And we are bringing you our year-end episode, I guess, right?
Year-end.
Yeah. We're calling it MacGyver Alive 5, because our guest this week is the incomparable Joel MacGyver. Richie came up with this idea of a great way to cap off 2015, and I couldn't agree more.
Yeah, well, last year we didn't do what we call a best-of show.
We don't do that. The shows do best-ofs and all
do
kinds
them.
Of stuff. And
but I decided to try and tackle it a little bit differently.
Well, plus
rather than lazy. Yeah.
I didn't want to have to go back through all kinds of audio and like pull together a best of show out of like all the audio, because that's just a whole bag of suck.
I know.
But when you give me this idea, I'm all for it.
Yeah, well, we haven't had Joel on in a while.
And 2014.
I know.
It's 2014.
Yeah, and he's a great guy to talk to. And I kind of, you know, I like doing shows where we talk about the year in metal, but last year we didn't do one. No. And I figured this year, rather than the two of us nattering on in the studio, we'd get Joel back on because Joel has a new book out of it on Rob Zombie. He's been pretty quiet on the book front, which he talks about in the interview. He brought out a book on Rob Zombie a couple of weeks ago. And one of the things I love about Joel when he comes on, we'll talk about the books, but we'll just go off and we'll just talk about Slayer and Sabbath, and it just goes somewhere else.
Mm-hmm.
And once or twice, even Joel has said, you know, he'd love to talk to us for a little bit longer.
Yeah.
So what I decided this year is I hit Joel up and I said, listen, Joel, we know you have the Rob Zombie book. Do you want to come on and we'll talk about the year in metal kind of thing? And he said, oh yeah. And I said, like, can we have an hour? And he said, sure. So we arranged the time and we scheduled it, and it was a great chat. We just touched on a lot of different things.
Yeah.
You know, we talked about Rob, the book, of course, but and what he's doing. He's still doing the Bass Guitar magazine and what books he's got coming up. But we just touched on all these different albums and bands and live shows, and we talked about current events.
Mm-hmm.
Just a great chat with him. As he said at the end of the interview, it's you know, he loves just coming on, and it's like three guys in a bar having a few beers, just talking shit. So that's the way I want the show to end for the year. Let's just have a conversation rather than a straight up interview session where, you know, you're going back and forth with pre-written questions and stuff like that. It's a conversation, see where you're going to go. And we touched on a lot.
Yeah, no, I think it was good. I think it was a great idea of a way to cap the year off. And I mean, honestly, I mean, to try to do a best of, you know, and we talked to Joel and we talked about some of the albums and stuff. For what we do, to try to remember like 12 months worth of what we've been hit for music in the year, it's like, holy shit. Even when you, and I guarantee I'll do the same thing next month. I'll get an album and I'll be like, oh yeah, this is going to be one of my top albums of the year. And 12 months later, I'll be lucky if I remembered that was one of my top albums of the year, no matter how good it was. It's and any best of list you go through, you start getting skewed to what happened from like September on.
Definitely, I agree. I agree 100%, which is why I actually wrote down some of mine, because some of mine were very early in the year.
Yeah.
And, you know, we're all getting old now and the brain cells they're not all there anymore. So, you know, you have short-term memory and it's like, oh crap, all the albums that came out in the last 3 weeks are my albums of the year because I can't remember any of the other ones. But, of course, Joel comes up with one bands that we've never heard of.
Yeah.
Which is the whole idea of doing this, because there's a lot of music out there and not everyone's going to like the same stuff.
And he is more into the death metal, black metal end of it than we are. So, you know, we know that going in, but he's all equally as versed in everything else as well. So it's very cool. But yeah, when you ask about, you know, albums, and I look at my freaking piles of CDs here and like be like, it's just, I mean, it is overload. You said that before. It's overload with the amount of stuff that comes out.
Yeah, but one of the great things I like talking to Joel about, especially when we do episodes like this, is we're not talking to Joel MacGyver, the author. We're talking to Joel MacGyver, the person who we think is a friend of the show now.
Yeah.
So we're just shooting the shit with him at this stage, which is the whole reason we do the show. Is we try and get on to a certain level with these guys where we can just talk about anything.
Yeah.
Really.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think, and we've gotten this developed this with you know, a few people now, and I think all of them all like that idea that they're going to go on and yeah, we'll help them promote whatever it is that they've got out recently, but then they just get to freaking talk.
Yeah,
you know, and I think I always enjoy those kind of interviews much better than, you know, the standard stuff.
Definitely.
Just shooting the shit. And
definitely.
I mean, even though, you know, when I've had like Chris Bennett on and you've been like, bloody hell, what did you talk to 2 hours? Like 2 hours? Are you shitting me?
Yeah.
But yeah, we just get together and the next thing you know, it's 2 hours have gone by and it's just, we've talked about all kinds of shit.
Yeah, but I've told you before, they're the interviews that I like. You get hit up with the 20-minute interviews, which are fine.
Yeah.
I'm not knocking them, but you just feel like you're getting somewhere and you got to go.
Yeah, it's true. Yeah, and I think sometimes it's frustrating with the artist, because I have had some of those press interviews where, you know, at the end, they've been like, Jesus, I wish we would have had more time.
John Oliva was one of them, wasn't he?
John was one guy that really wanted to keep going for, you know, definitely there was stuff that there where he really wanted to dig in on stuff and was having a lot of fun.
Yeah.
And there's been a lot of other ones like that too, that they just, yeah, these guys, they so much like not having to do that standard, you know, radio thing where they know usually half the time, like, this fucker didn't even listen to my album, or they don't even know who the hell they're talking to, or you know what I mean? So yeah, I love this kind of shoot the shit thing.
Definitely. Definitely. You know, PR companies are great. We really appreciate them doing what they do for the show.
Yeah.
But sometimes it's great to go straight to the person, schedule it directly with the person.
Yeah.
And I find those conversations, for me anyway, when you can go a little bit longer than normal,
right,
you really can get somewhere with the person.
Right. But we do have relationships with a lot of PR companies now, too, that do give us off schedule. Like, you know, the band will have done a whole press run and they hit us up afterwards and give us whatever time, you know, an hour, 45 minutes, whatever. And it's like the only thing that guy's doing that day. So we do get lucky that a lot of PR companies do that for us now.
Yeah, that's true. It's happened probably more this year than before, which is great. You get certain PR people that'll hit us up and we'll tell them when we can do the interview. And most of the time now, like when I schedule an interview, they won't even tell me how long I have.
Yeah. You know, yeah, I know. It's the first thing. It's like, hey, how much time do we have? And usually they're like, oh, I didn't think about it. Usually it depends not on a next interview, but like they've got to be somewhere.
Yeah.
You know, or in the case of Jolene Turner, it was just like, well, I guess until my wife's appointment's done.
Yeah. That was a great interview. That was. But sometimes you'll get the email sent out to you. They'll say, it'll be a mass email. He's doing phone or some. This time from every half hour intervals. Yeah. But if you can go, if you get to know the PR guy and you can say, look, can I schedule an interview with the guy? And he sets it up himself directly. You can normally get around that a little bit.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. Well, why don't we just, when we roll our talk with Joel?
Yeah, I'll let Joel talk.
So it's time for some MacGyver Alive 5.
Hey, fellas.
Hey, Joel. How you doing?
Hey, Joel. How are we doing, man?
Yeah, nice to hear from you guys. Hey, how are you?
Great.
Excellent. Good.
So how have you been?
Oh, everything's going pretty well, thank you, mate.
Well, cool. I mean, it's great to have you back on, and we're calling this one MacGyver Alive 5. It's been your fifth appearance on Focus on Metal, and we freaking love having you all on. So it's when Richie said, "Hey, we're gonna have Joel back on," I was like, "All right, clear the decks."
And I love being on the show, and I really, really appreciate the support you guys give me, man. It's really appreciated.
Oh, no problem. I mean, hey, you keep churning out such great crap, and how was that? Great crap, right? But I mean, you know, between you and Martin Popoff, you know, two authors we'd love to keep having on the show, because you guys keep putting out really great stuff that isn't really being addressed in a really good, solid, valid way. So always love to let people know what you guys are up to.
That's lovely to hear. That's very kind of you to say. And it's interesting because Martin and I are really good friends, as I've said before, and we're both doing similar jobs but on opposite sides of the pond. And the trick in both our cases is to keep quality high, because when you put out loads of books, as we do, I mean, it's not, you know, we do other things. I mean, I do probably two books a year. He does maybe three. It's just we've been doing it for a lot of years. So when people say to you, oh, how many books have you written? And I say, well, I've done 27, and Martin's probably done twice as many as that. People assume that quality is going down because you put so much out, and that's a reasonable assumption to make. So you have to make sure that quality stays high. So to hear you say that is very gratifying. Thank you.
Awesome. We just had Martin on like 3 weeks ago, and I want to ask you the question that I asked Martin too, because I'm interested in your take. But right before I was calling Martin the other night, I'm on Skype and I'm looking at all these numbers in Skype, and I just was like, would the 17-year-old me have believed that I'd be looking at this address book and the different people that are in it? And do you ever like get into that thing of you look at your address book and go, holy crap, this is really messed up of the people that I have in my address book and that I could just pick up and call at any given time?
This is a subject that is quite dear to me, actually. So a lot of people in my position who are lucky enough to be able to meet their heroes on a regular basis tend to lose that kind of sense of wonder. And it becomes the norm. And I have tried not to let that happen because I want to still be the kid who's got stardust, you know, and is like, oh my God, I'm going to speak to Tony Iommi and or whatever, or whoever it may be. And clearly you can't be like that all the time because, you know, you're in a professional environment and these people, like Martin, are my colleagues in a sense. But I think it's important from time to time to be really grateful that you get this chance and to be kind of, and to, I don't mean exploit, but make the most of that, you know, really think to yourself, man, this is nuts. This is crazy. So not only do I do it from time to time, I actually think it's important to do it because it reminds you why you got into this. And sometimes, when you're working hard, any job can seem like a job, you know, that you've got to get through. But I take the time on a regular basis to think, no, this is, you're really lucky to be doing this and to be doing something creative with amazing people. So I totally understand that point, and I feel the same way as you.
Awesome.
Yeah, yeah. Joel, have you ever thought of going down the self-publishing route like Martin does with some of his books?
I haven't thought about it really. I haven't discounted the idea. What I might do is, and there is a subtle difference between this, I may not self-publish, I may set up a publishing house, which is slightly different in that it involves a sort of corporate structure and a kind of a an investment and a plan, a business plan, obviously, and stuff like that, which I may do in a couple of years. So there's a particular band, a particular German thrash metal band that I've been working with, and that may be the first book in a couple of years. It's not something I'm going to do right now because I'm kind of booked up really now until into 2017.
Yeah.
So no, I haven't self-published anything. I'm not against the idea by any means. But what I think I will do is actually become a publisher in a couple of years and actually set up a company that does it rather than, as Martin and a lot of other fine authors do, self-publish their books on a sort of case-by-case basis.
Yeah. Now let's talk about a book that recently came out. I know you've been a bit quiet on the book front this year, but you just recently released a Rob Zombie book.
I did, yeah. It's the only one of mine that's coming out this year.
And it's near and dear to ours because, of course, you know, being outside of Boston. So, you know, yeah. Rob's sort of a local hero.
Well, you know, he really is an East Coaster, isn't he? I mean, in so many things that he does. And you guys would know more than me, but, I mean, all the Americans I know definitely see a difference in themselves between living in the West and living in the East, right?
Yeah.
And perhaps rather similar to the North-South thing in Britain. And he has always had that kind of ballsy, no bullshit thing that as far as I understand, people from that part of the world tend to possess. Yes, it's the only book of mine that's come out this year, not because I'm not working on 10 different books, because I am, but probably a load will come out next year and a bunch the following year. And it's just the way the schedules fall. So yeah, it's called Sinister Urge, The Life and Times of Rob Zombie, and it's half and half a discussion of his music and the other half is a discussion of his films, because I think that's a hugely important part of his activity and of his persona, you know, and I really enjoyed getting into that. So, yeah, I think that's out. That's been out a couple of weeks officially, but I've been doing press for it for a little while longer. Did they send you one?
No.
OK, look, I've got the email address of the guy at Hal Leonard who will send you copies. All right.
Excellent.
So I'll get that. I'll get onto this after this.
Yeah. All right, Joel. One of the things I want to ask you about Rob Zombie, it seems to me that ever since the likes of him and Marilyn Manson, there's no, a lot of the musicians, they're faceless. They're talented, but when you look back at larger than life personas when it comes to musicians, it really stops with Marilyn Manson and Rob Zombie. And ever since then, like, I think Rammstein were around the same time, but a lot of it now is like they're like faceless musicians. Like if I said, if I put the four guys in Nickelback in front of you, you probably wouldn't be able to pick them out of a lineup, you know?
Well, it's interesting. I suppose what you really mean is that kind of sort of shocking theatrical image has not really been applied since.
Yeah,
right? Well, there is Slipknot, remember, who did their own thing when they came out in 99, which was a year after Rob went solo from White Zombie.
Yeah.
Rammstein, you're absolutely right. I mean, they're a great example of a band that has an enormous production and an image. And they kind of delve into sort of dark, sinister tones with their image and their look. Yes, I do think that. You've had a few slightly less successful bands like Black Veil Brides and Mushroom Head and a few other bands who've done some sort of slightly interesting theatrical stuff. But the full-on thing that Rob Zombie does, and as you say, Marilyn Manson continues to do, has not really been that popular lately. I think there's a kind of a wheel of fashion thing, you know, the pendulum swings. You know, you get all this kind of crazy over-the-top. I hate the phrase shock rock, but it really does work. Shock rock stuff. And then after a while, people sort of go, well, no, I'm going to sort of do the plaid shirt or the Nickelback thing or the Pearl Jam thing and be authentic, which is fine too. And then a couple of years later, people get bored of that and they start looking for the more over the top kind of look again. And either approach is fine. You know, I mean, it's you can't take it all too seriously. I happen to love Rob Zombie's look and his production. And the interesting thing for me is the way that the style of his shows has been taken over into his directorial style as a filmmaker, which I think is great. Interesting man in many, many ways.
Yeah. Did you interview him before?
Yeah, twice.
Okay.
This is not an authorized book, but there was no way it would have become authorized. But he was very happy to give permission to a couple of people to do interviews with me for the book. So the fact that he didn't actually get in his way says quite a lot. And that was great. He didn't need to do that, but he did. I quoted extensively from a couple of interviews I'd done for him with him previously. And I tracked down an awful lot of people. Sean Isilt, obviously, from White Zombie, gave me an interview. She's amazing, that woman. A real pioneer, you know, in what she did.
Of course, you're a bass player biased.
Well, I am. Got that right. No, and she's a killer bass player. And, you know, I don't want to follow the hackneyed route of she pioneered a sort of a woman's role in rock, although she did, but she's much more than that. She, like Rob, put in an awful lot of groundwork in establishing White Zombie in the early days. And I wasn't really a huge fan of White Zombie's music until the second album, really, the second major label album. But going back and listening to the kind of art house stuff that they did, man, you've got to understand, it was a completely different world, right? Now, you guys know because you're music professionals, but a lot of people won't know that the art rock scene, noise rock scene, really, in New York in the late 80s, which was dominated by Sonic Youth, White Zombie were a huge part of that, right? And that's an area which has not really been explored. Now, I explored it in the book in the detail that it deserved. I would like to have gone further into that stuff, except that I think the music isn't that great that White Zombie made back then. I really don't. You know, they didn't quite have I don't want to say the artistic vision, because they clearly had that. But they didn't necessarily have the ability to stand out in that crowd like Sonic Youth did.
Right.
So when they switched towards that metal thing, which was sort of influenced by Pantera a bit, that's when they found their niche, and that's when the music got good. But for anyone who doesn't know the story of Rob Zombie, the roots of White Zombie are really interesting. And he really didn't get going until he was 30. Not really. Not as a successful musician, or maybe even a bit later. I mean, he's just turned 50, hasn't he, this year? or last year. But so he persevered, and there's a whole catalogue of music. I mean, tons of albums and tons of EPs and limited vinyl pressings and stuff like that from the early part of his career, which most people haven't heard. Some of it is on YouTube. A lot of the vinyl you can find, but it's very expensive. They did do that big box set in 2008, and they're busy putting together one now as well, or a bunch of reissues. I can't remember what the format is. But anyway, so without rambling on too much, the arc of the book is interesting to me. I always want to have an interesting shape to a book. And this one was particularly interesting because Rob Zombie came from nothing. I mean, this like ridiculous sort of dropout student music that was very arty and really hard to listen to, streamlined his sound, became this huge selling musician, and then went into films. I mean, that's amazing to me. That blows my mind.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. It is great that you are bringing out, you know, that whole New York scene in there. That's cool that you've got that detailed in there, because you're right. I mean, by and large, it was kind of like, you know, Thurston Moore is a god. You know, that was always the main focus of anything that went on that scene was that. So to have some, I always love when a book gives some other perspective and gives you some thought and insight into something. So good. I'm looking forward to reading that part of the book.
I'm really glad to hear that, because I've tried to do that a few times in my book and my books. And I worked for 6 years, as I'm sure you know, on a magazine called Record Collector. And it's the geekiest sort of vinyl obsessed magazine in the world. But what that magazine gives you is an incredible training in digging deep into people's past, because you want to tell an incredibly detailed story with no details missed out. Mm-hmm. So I've taken that discipline to the books I've written. So as a result, you've got the Queens of the Stone Age book that I did back in, I think, 2006. Half the book is about Caius, you know, and what they did in the Joshua Tree up there. And before you even get to the Queens of the Stone Age story, because I really wanted to get into the background. It's the same with the Machine Head book I did. I spent a lot of time talking about the Bay Area scene, the thrash scene that they came from. And then subsequently things like this Rob Zombie book, where there's a whole background thing to be explored. I love doing that. And I think books have a duty to do that where that stuff is not publicly known.
Yeah.
Try and dig deep. Speak to the people. Dig deep for people you can talk to. And I spoke to Peter Landau, who... God, what did he do? I think he played drums, did he not? In a very, very early version of White Zombie. I think he was the drummer. I mean, that guy, great guy, you know, but no one's really heard of him. He has a band now, but it's not very well known. There was a guy, what the hell was his name, in the Rage Against the Machine book I did a couple of years ago, who had been in a pre-Rage band. He was in, was he in Lock Up with Tom Morello? I can't remember, but the point is that this is someone who is not known now, but played a really, really important role in this band's trajectory. And that was what I tried to do as well with this Rob Zombie book. So, and what was nice was that people were very keen to talk. You know, he has good relationships with people. A few people have been and gone through his bands, but there are a lot of people that have a lot of affection for him, which is always a good sign, I think.
And you're right. I mean, things like, you know, you talk about the Queens of the Stone Age book. I mean, to think that they came, you know, fully formed, it would be impossible. So it's great that you went back to Caius, because I mean, so much of what Josh brought into Queens, I mean, that's all with what those guys, you know, what they did, that sound and how we developed all that technique is, I mean, if you don't talk about Caius, you leave people really questioning what the heck happened here.
You know, I would love to have really done a Caius book. I mean, I did enjoy doing that, the story of Queens, because they're such a band. But I would love to do or someday get into some sort of Caius book. There's a German photographer who did one a couple of years ago, a little limited run. A really, really good book, actually. She sent me one. But the full story has not really been told outside pictures. So that is a hell of a story, man. That whole thing in the desert, you know, where they would, in about 1987, you'd get these bands that would go out and play in the middle of fucking nowhere.
Yep.
They would have a generator, or they would hook power up from the lights, you know, the pylons, and fire up their bands and just play and play all night. And they didn't have a tuner. The guitars never had tuners, so they would tune down to C or ridiculously low things and just jam all night and go nuts. And there'd be sand flying everywhere. Half of them were on peyote or acid. And that scene would have been fun to visit, I think. You know, I mean, it's 25 years ago now.
Yeah, and the thing that's interesting, too, on that, and you as a bass player appreciates this, is the fact that if you're playing out in the middle of nowhere, that you can't have a high end. The only way to have, you know, a sonic impact is you have to make everything low end, so you're just pushing massive amounts of air.
Exactly. I've become chums with Scott Reeder, actually, who was in Caius, obviously, and he is a great guy.
Hmm.
And it's been, and talk, you said earlier, what's it like? You know, you look at your phone, the contact, and the people you see. I mean, God, meeting that guy was amazing.
Yeah.
Oh, we could go on.
So, Joel, you're still involved with the Bass Guitar magazine?
Yeah, I'm still editing Bass Guitar Mag. I've been doing that 3.5 years now, and I edit an issue of that every 4 weeks. And there is a show attached to the magazine called the London Bass Guitar Show, which comes out, which happens every March. So we're sort of ramping up towards that. The Bass Mag takes up about, I want to say, about 40% of my time, depending on the time of year, really. So, for example, the office is shutting down over Christmas right now, so it's a bit of a stretch. It's a bit busy in the run-up to Christmas. But other than that, it's a very easy gig. The company who own it are called Blaze Publishing, up in Leamington Spa in the middle of Britain. And the guy who runs it is a super, super cool guy. He makes it very, very easy for me. And it's a lot of fun to do. It's great. I mean, you know, again, it comes back to what you were saying before. I have a wish list of bassists that I put on my cover. I could make them all metal, but I wouldn't really serve the readership who are not all metal people. So I've had the major guys on there. I had Steve Harris on there. Tom Araya was on the last one. Tim Comerford, actually, from Rage Against the Machine, is on the one that's out now. Robert Trujillo was on. There's a Cliff Burton one coming up in September because that'll be 30 years since Cliff died.
But
all these other guys as well. I mean, I had the guy from Duran Duran on there. You know, I've got all these funk players and sort of cheesy pop players as well. It's a lot of fun.
Yeah, there's a bass player. No, I don't play at all, but there's a bass player I used to love years ago. It was the guy at a level 42.
So Mark is a friend of mine, right?
Yeah.
He's been on the cover twice since I've been doing it, and he is an awesome guy, and he's still an insane bass player.
Yeah.
I mean, we went over to his house the other day to do a photo shoot for the cover, and we were all playing his bass, me and the guys that were there, and that thing is like, it's like a weapon. And the music is cool, kind of pop funk, you know?
Yeah.
It's cool to me. I mean, it's not cool to anyone in the world, you know? I mean, it's very, very 80s pop music. But the story of that guy's life is amazing. I mean, he made an insane amount of money in the 80s and 90s, and he could have retired in 1994, but he chose not to, you know? He came back with a band and did other stuff. And he's a good guy, Mark. Yeah, I hope you get to meet him sometime. He's a lot of fun.
Forged from the fires that created a long-lost brotherhood of podcasts comes the Blast Syndicate. We are made up of Focus on Metal, Inside Metal, Iron City Rocks, Mars Attacks, Metal Geeks, MSR Cast, Neckbreaker, Radioactive Metal, and Wiki Metal. We are the Blast Syndicate. Go to blastsyndicate.com to find out more. Get blasted.
So the other day I was reading an article. I immediately thought of you, and I was like, I'm going to love to ask Joel this question.
Okay.
And, you know, obviously I'm a gear guy, and
yeah.
Like I've got about 3 brand new stomp boxes. I've even yet to open the box on yet. But, you know, the article was all about where we are today with effects pedals and how we've gone way past that era of you had like 3 pedals for bassist and a million for guitarist. That now you've got, you know, these pedals that go, that could easily be between either or, you know, like Electro Harmonix, but they put out their Soul Food, then they put out the bass Soul Food, which is actually even better for guitar than the original Soul Food one was.
Right.
And so what's your take on the current state of bass effects?
Oh man, I love it. I mean, it's a bizarre world. And one of the things I've noticed is the rise of little boutique manufacturers.
Yes.
Who I mean,
you've got Magnetic Effects over there. I'm very jealous.
I know that they're great. And there's tons and tons of little, and I swear there's workshops all over America and Europe where with a guy working in a shed at the bottom of his garden, knocking out a pedal a week.
Yeah, the best, the one I found lately is Tomcat Pedals out of the Bronx, Tom Cougat, who's actually a drummer. But he does fantastic pedals, does them all himself. He's totally anally obsessive inside and out on them. He's got the artwork's done by a tattoo artist over in the UK.
That's cool.
And, I mean, his stuff, I've got 2 of his pedals so far. I love both of them. They're both fuzzes. They're both different kinds of fuzzes. And I mean, the work is amazing. And then what I pay for them, I can't believe that what I'm getting for what I'm paying for them. It's insane. So, yeah, I'm totally with you with these boutique guys.
And the thing you said about the bass and guitar effects crossing over, I think some of that might be to do with bands like Royal Blood. I know what the guy's signal chain is, but I've forgotten it. He's got some sort of, what the hell is it? I can't remember. But it's a fairly routine sort of multi-effects thing. And what's that other band? Drenge, are they called? They have they do a similar thing where the bass player creates a guitar-like tone, and of course that's been going back as far as the White Stripes, hasn't it? Jack White did the same thing.
Yeah.
I love it. I think it's a really interesting evolution. And the fact is that these effects are not insanely expensive either. You know, you can pick them up, a little handmade thing for a couple of $100. I think it's amazing.
Yeah.
But you know, there you go.
Yeah, I just think it's come along so far. I mean, I remember back in the early 80s when I was playing bass, and the fact that I had like an envelope filter in my signal chain was like freaked everybody out. And like,
quite progressive, you know.
You know?
I tended to use a Boss distortion pedal for guitar because you couldn't really get bass distortion. I don't think you did for quite a while, did you?
No, you couldn't.
These amazing ones by Aguilar and TC Electronic, and everyone you want to name is doing one.
Yeah, well, except for like what Electro Harmonix had the baseballs. I think that was probably the only one.
Yeah, which Cliff Burton used, didn't he?
Yes.
I have a baseballs here actually, an old. I think it's a Russian one. It's a cheesy sort of. But not the proper thing. But yeah, oh man, exciting times to be a musician generally. You know, I mean, you know, with the music industry being dead or effectively so, you know, what a great time to take the music back to your own studio with your own computer and stick it out on what is it called? Sound. What's the major platform? What do they call it? Can't remember. But you can send your music out there, and you know, it's whether you make money out of it is a whole other issue. But you know, at least you can control the stuff and distribute it. That's the main thing.
Yep.
Yeah. So, Joel, normally when we have you on, we talk about the books that you've released, and we never really get a chance to talk to you about what books are you reading at the moment. Like, what books that came out this year that you really liked? Music books.
That's a great question, and I'm trying to think if I can answer it. Those came out. You'll have to remind me. What are the cool biogs that came out this year?
Oh, well, some of Martin Popoff's ones I liked. He did one on Whitesnake, and
his stuff is always reliable, man. That guy knocks out a completely solid thing. Let me think, because I get his stuff sent to me.
The other one I liked, and it only came out this year in the US, and I actually hate the band, but I love the author, is Mick Wall did a book on The Doors. That's really good.
No, I have that book, and it is really good. I went to the launch of it actually in Oxford.
Yeah,
at Blackwell's bookshop there, and that's an interesting. I mean, it's an interesting story. I mean, God, it's the whole of heaven and hell and life and death, isn't it? You know, that story. Yes, I read and I really enjoyed that book. I read everything that Mick writes. He's a really good friend of mine. Yeah, we meet every 6 months to a year, and we talk to each other about where we're at. He only lives about half an hour drive away from me, and he's, I think, 13 years older than me, but he's got 20 years more experience because he got started way before I did.
Yeah.
He has really helped me out with some advice. I remember working on books, and I wasn't sure of a particular point when it came to the deal. I wasn't sure of a particular editorial direction, and he really helped me out with some clear-headed advice. So, no, I owe Mick a lot. He's a lovely guy. In fact, I am working. I'll give you an exclusive. Actually, I'm working on Thunder's book. You remember the band Thunder?
Oh, I want to talk to you about them.
Cool. Right. Well, so they are doing a book and an official sort of memoir, which is coming out at some point next year, and I'm the writer.
Excellent.
So I have spent the last 3 months or so working with them, interviewing the hell out of all of them, like current members, ex-members, and Mick Wall was one of the guys who one of the first journalists to discover them, really, and give them the exposure they deserved back in, I want to say, 1990. And so I've got to speak to Mick. Anyway, we have a curry, like I say, every 6 months, but I've got to interview him as well for this book. So no, he's a great, great guy, and really, really the leader that we all kind of look up to when it comes to rock biography and rock autobiography.
Yeah. Who you need to talk to, Joel, about Thunder is as well as Mike Fraser.
Yeah, the engineer, yeah?
Yeah, we've had him on the show numerous times. He's a great guy.
Very, very talented man. And I think, actually, did he not actually go on to produce their records as well?
He did. He mixed Backstreet Symphony.
That's it.
He did. I think he was involved in Laughing on Judgment Day.
I think he might even.
He mixed a new one.
Yeah, he did, yeah. And what a great album that is, too.
Super. Super album.
About them. And I've got to know them quite well, the five of them, plus, you know, the people who work with them and around them, is they have this sort of self-contained industry. They really, really have read where the industry's going, and they know what to do. They've got plenty of budget. And the reason they have that is because everything is self-contained. Danny, the singer, is also the manager.
Mm.
They don't waste any money. They don't take any crap off anybody. They're inventive. They write good songs. They're completely on the ball when it comes to modern stuff like social media. And they're in touch with their fans. And they have this really, really loyal fan base. Like thousands of people. They're playing fucking Wembley Arena in February. And which band of their genre and vintage is doing that, right? I mean, as I see it, there wasn't a band in Britain. There are plenty of American bands who had that sound at the time, but they weren't really in Britain. You had things like the Choir Boys, and you had, I guess, Little Angels, I suppose.
Yeah.
But Thunder really led that pack and did really, really well until their career was effectively killed by grunge. For temporarily, thank God, and then they came back later on and continued as before. But that's again, I mentioned earlier, I like the fact that there's an interesting arc, a career arc in any biography, and this being their official, it's their autobiography, so by definition it's official, has that and really does follow the rise and the fall and the rise again in great detail. So that's been a lot of fun.
Yeah.
I don't know when it's coming out. It's probably coming out next summer or the third quarter or something like that, but that's been a right laugh. I went to their I wanted to get them in a situation where they were all a bit drunk, so they would tell me some crazy stories. I said to Danny, when are you all going to be in a pub or whatever? And they're all family men, they're working hard, they live in different places, so it doesn't happen too often. But they had a photo shoot in London last month, and they said, well, we're going to have a photo shoot, and then we're all going to have lunch and have a few drinks, so why don't you come along to that? So I went, and I sat there, and I kind of threw a few questions in here and there, and they all sat around laughing, and telling me ribald stories, some of which may not appear in the book. But, so that's been a great laugh. That's been a lot of fun.
They were one of these bands that they didn't break up. They used to play a couple of gigs every Christmas, and right. Luke went and was the band Union.
The Union, yeah.
Yeah, and so. Next thing I know, they're back together. And I remember a while back there was a great interview in Classic Rock. Was it Ben had cancer?
He did, yeah.
And it was a really, really touching interview. They interviewed the five guys in the band, and you know, they're back now, firing on all cylinders. And I wonder, his album is excellent.
It really is, isn't it? And Ben's a super guy. I've got to know him quite well. In fact, I'm seeing him tomorrow. I'm going to his house tomorrow. But he had what's called head and neck cancer, which is when it appears somewhere in your throat, essentially. And he told me, actually, that the doctor said to him, well, there's good news and bad news. The good news is that this is pretty much the most curable cancer that there is. You know, you've got something like a 98% chance of surviving this. But the bad news is that the treatment is utterly horrible. And so it proved to be, because apparently everything in your body goes through your neck at some point, right? Because obviously all the blood in your body has to go to your brain and to your heart and back again. So your throat is this incredibly important connection. So if there's something wrong with it and treatment is happening in that area, then it's just a nightmare for the whole of your system. So yeah, he was absolutely, I think he told me he was completely exhausted and unable to move for the best part of 18 months. And but now he's back and completely fit and happy and well. And it's amazing. Amazing.
Yeah. So what other albums this year, Joel, have done it for you?
Oh, what albums?
Yeah. Albums.
I was asked this the other day and I made a list and I'm trying to remember what it was.
All right. I'm going to touch.
I made an album. I enjoyed quite a lot of that Iron Maiden album.
Yeah.
I thought the Slayer album was slightly disappointing, but there are a couple of good tunes on there, which I enjoyed. What else? There's a couple of songs that I really liked. I liked Faith No More, but I'm a ridiculous Faith No More fanboy, so I'm probably not the best person to judge because I like everything they do. What else? Oh, there's a band here called... okay, you remember Aka Cocker?
No.
Oh, you never heard of them?
No.
Oh, gotta check them out. They did five albums, three of them for Eric in the 2000s. So it's Aka Cocker, right? Google it. And they split up. Well, they haven't split up. They're on a hiatus. And I've become really good mates with those guys. And they have two bands of split off from the ACK, one called Voices and one called the Antichrist Imperium. Absolutely brilliant. And they've both put out these miserably violent albums, which are they're death metal, but they're also super. They have all these elements that are sort of goth-like, like The Cure. Mm-hmm. And you know, like The Cult and sort of cool Fields of the Nephilim kind of stuff as well. So if you imagine death metal mixed with that, that's essentially what Aka Cocker was like back in the day. And this is two new bands which have come from Aka Cocker, and they both had albums out this year. So check them out. That's Voices and the Antichrist Imperium. They're really, really good bands.
Okay. Let's go back to the Maiden album a little bit, Joel, because when that came out, Classic Rock gave it 9 out of 10 and Metal Hammer gave it 10 out of 10. And I was thinking... Look, wow, like the praise on that album has been unbelievable.
Well, a Maiden album isn't just a release, it's an event, you know. And I think people like the sense of specialness that comes when a Maiden album comes out. So, I mean, obviously those reviewers love those records to death. I didn't think it was worth a 9 or a 10 out of 10. Mm-hmm. But here and there, you know, some of those songs were great. I couldn't stop listening to The Red and the Black for ages. Mm. It had this, I think I posted it on Facebook, it has this one section which is ridiculously catchy. And once it got in my head, I just could not stop listening to it. The thing is with Maiden is that you've got to love them. You know, you can't not love Maiden, I think, because whether or not you like the new record, it's like Metallica. It's not really relevant whether you like the new record. They're out there playing songs that with a catalogue that is unparalleled. I mean, the stuff they've written over the last 25 years or whatever it is just gobsmackingly good, a lot of it. Although, like all bands, that you know, they've had their dodgy moments, and there are a few bands like that who, you know, I'll always go and see, I'll always try and feature in the various magazines, and I'll always kind of take seriously. And there are some which you can't feel that generous about. But with Maiden, I think people have a lot of affection for them, you know, and quite rightly so.
Yeah, I think Maiden, they just do whatever they want, and you know, what other band would release a double album 90 something minutes in these days? You know, nobody.
Well, I think the question is more, what other band will do that and then sell out a massive stadium in every country of the world? You can release a double album quite easily. It's usually the kiss of death, isn't it? Because you know, no one has the time to listen to a double album anymore. But the fact is they then go and sell out 100,000 seat stadiums. that destroys me. The fact that they have that commercial power, I love it. I think it's great. And people say that heavy metal is a niche interest. You know, that always destroys me as well.
Yeah. They sell out stadiums and they don't get any radio airplay at all.
No, not much. That's true. Not much.
I think even when I was back in Ireland, Joel, in the 80s and early 90s, I remember on Top of the Pops, they used to go straight into number one or number two. They wouldn't play them at all. And the next week they were gone down the charts because nobody had played their music.
Very clearly, yeah. So what were the albums that did it for you guys this year?
Well, I love the Europe album.
Oh, yeah. I haven't heard it. Was it good?
Yeah. The Black Star Riders album I like too.
Yeah, it's fantastic.
Night Demon. Have you heard of them?
No, I haven't, no.
Yeah, Curse of the Damned. It's very new album sounding. Really good.
Cool, great.
That's Bob Nalbandian approved as well.
Well, if he approves it, that means a lot.
Yeah, I like the Act of Defiance album. Sean Drover and Chris Broderick.
Two guys who left Megadeth, yeah. They're cool guys. I interviewed them, obviously, for David Ellison's book, which I did a couple of years ago, and we talked about. I'd be interested to see how that band goes. I haven't actually heard the music other than the couple of clips I saw on Facebook, YouTube. Yeah. But the album is good, is it?
Oh, yeah, it's very good.
Yeah, definitely.
I think it'll be right up your alley. It's a little more guttural in the vocals than Megadeth. You'd like the other album I really liked was Pharmacos. Joe Holmes used to be an Aussies band.
That's a new one on me. No, that's good.
The Queensryche album is very good as well.
Yeah, it's fantastic.
And Mark Tremonti's new album, Tremonti Cauterize, is very good.
Yeah. And then right up your alley is the album from Once Human. You must have heard that one, right?
I know I've heard of them, but I couldn't tell you the album.
You'll love it, Joel.
Worth a listen.
Oh, definitely. I think they are like heir to the arch enemy throne. I mean, it's got that same feel. Lauren Hart is just fantastic on vocals, you know, both sides of it, whether it be, you know, a growl or a melodic and just fantastic stuff and lyrics that you want to listen to.
Excellent. That's good. Did you hear the new Megadeth yet?
No, I've only heard this two songs.
It's good. It's I was interviewing Ellison the other day for Bass Guitar Mag, and I've known him for years, and I said, look, man, I really didn't enjoy Super Collider and 13. I just thought they were weak, but this one is much better. It's much, much more aggressive, much faster, much. It's just better on all levels, and that it was good to hear. I think you're going to enjoy it. Basically, those two songs that you've heard are kind of like the rest of the record. There's a lot of balls and a lot of speed. Nice. It's not full on thrash, obviously, but it's not far off it. And I saw them live as well the other day with Lamb of God supporting, and it was the day after the Paris attacks.
Ooh.
So it's quite a sort of emotional evening, and but they were fully on it. I mean, they really, really did lay it down.
Yeah, I'd say Chris Adler was pretty tired at the end of that night.
Well, he didn't look it. I mean, you know, the parts he was playing with Lamb of God were way tougher than the ones he was playing with Megadeth. So I guess he kind of gets his workout done at the start of the evening, and then it's not nothing, obviously, the stuff you play when you play drums in Megadeth, especially the new material. But it's not quite as aggressive. So you know, didn't he say somewhere that normally he runs 10 miles a day? So instead, he just plays drums twice in that band.
Yeah, I remember a few years ago, was it John Detty played with Anthrax and Slayer on the same bill, and I'm thinking, no, that's a workout.
I was at a gig the other day, you know, Nile, the band Nile?
Yeah.
What's the name? Kevin Talley was there. He was playing drums for Nile. And he was in loads of bands when he was in Misery Index and all this stuff. And he auditioned for Slayer back in, well, it would have been 2001 when Paul Bostaph left and Dave Lombardo came back. And why was I telling that story? Because it was just really, really amazing to find out what it was like to audition for Slayer. Basically, it was just in a room with Kerry King and they ran through a couple of songs. And ultimately, the gig went back to Lombardo. But and talking of Slayer, and as you know, Slayer, I always talk about Slayer. I interviewed Paul Bostaph just the other day, and I've never interviewed him before. The other guys I've interviewed many, many times, but he was a good guy. Really liked him. We talked about death metal versus thrash metal and how that's different in terms of heavy metal drums, which was interesting. You know, he can do those blast beats, but he's primarily a thrash guy. And that band, I personally didn't think the record was that good, Repentance, but it doesn't really matter because they're kind of on fire. You know, the Anthrax are touring with them, aren't they? And apparently it's a really, really good gig.
Yeah.
I was going to say, on the subject of music, there's been a lot of good non-metal stuff as well. I've been listening to a lot of blues lately. There's this, if you want a hot tip, check out this woman called Rebecca Downes. Her surname is Downes, Rebecca Downes. British woman, a hell of a singer. Really, really cool electric blues. You know, loads of sort of cool Stevie Ray Vaughan kind of tips and all that cool stuff. So if you're in the mood for something that's a little bit more, less aggressive than usual Lamb of God and stuff we talk about, check her out. She's great.
Yeah. Now, one of the things, you mentioned Lamb of God there, and one of the books I never asked, did you read the Randy Blythe book?
Yeah, I did. I read it, reviewed it, and emailed my review to Randy. Yeah. He did a hell of a job.
Yeah, I still got to read it, Joel.
You should read it. It's really good.
Yeah,
it essentially recounts what everyone knows, what happened in the Czech Republic, but it's also his life story and his battle with the booze that, you know, so many people go through, but he came through successfully. And but also there's a fair bit of personal tragedy in there as well, which is worth reading about. But no, that was good. He did a good job.
Yeah,
it's a massive hardback. You know, you need a bit of time to sit down. It's worth it.
You know, also, you know, with Randy, another album that Randy appeared on this year was the Metal Allegiance album as well, which is also a fantastic one.
I thought the album was amazing, really, really good. And you can tell they're having so much fun banging through it. It was, wasn't it Ellefson, mm-hmm. Alex Skolnick, Mike Portnoy?
Yeah, yeah.
And Mark Menge, who used to work for Heartkey, I want to say. But yeah. And then a bunch of singers, yeah. And no, that was really good. Oh, and wasn't Andreas Kisser on it?
He was.
Yeah, he was. And the DVD, if you get the edition with the DVD,
yeah.
You know, you see them, you know, going through each song and recording process, and you can tell that those guys are just having a freaking blast.
You know,
doing it, you know, and just having a ton of fun. And I think it's the one with, I think Andreas is the one who starts doing like a Peanut song or something. Like they're asking him to cut a solo when he starts playing something just absolutely ridiculous. And they all just let him do it. It might have even been like a Mickey Mouse Club or something, but it was something totally off topic. And then they just lost their shit when he was done.
You know, a lot of bands do their best work when the pressure is off.
Yeah.
And they don't have to worry about stuff. I mean, those guys are all in bands, you know, the mothership bands, which require a lot of their time and effort and have demanding fans. But this particular one, it didn't really matter if it did well or not. There's going to be another album, apparently. And I imagine they'll continue to do it. I mean, it sounded so professional. All those guys are, you know, masters of their instrument.
Mm-hmm.
I really loved the song that Phil Anselmo sang on, actually. I can't remember what it was called, but it was that. It was kind of downy, wasn't it? Sort of heavy atmospheric thing, which absolutely great.
We'll be right back.
it's such a good time to be into metal at the moment. If you're listening to metal, I think rather than making it as a professional musician, when it's very tough, but actually for people who like metal and who like music in general, it's a good time.
Yeah.
Yeah, definitely. And yeah, we had Alex on the show talking about the whole Metal Allegiance project. And you could just tell the way he was talking about it, too, that it just really came together really natural and real, like an old school band.
Yeah. You know, and I've seen this when I've spoken to Portnoy and Ellefson and Skolnick. You say, you talk about their main band, you know, and they're all like really serious. Well, you know, we're going to come out hard on the next band. And they say, so how was Metal Allegiance? And there's this palpable relaxation of tension, isn't there? And they go, oh, man, that was so much fun. Oh, it was great. I loved it. We went in there, we bashed it out, we laughed our balls off and made a really, really good album. So, yeah, it's good for people to have that that kind of outlet, I think.
You know? Yeah.
Yeah, Joel, I just want to talk to you about, were you able to make it to any of the festivals in the UK this year?
Where did we go?
Did you make it to Download?
I skipped Download this year because I can't remember why the lineup didn't really appear. It was Muse, wasn't it?
Yeah, I was going to ask you about Muse. What's your take on them headlining Download?
Oh, I'm really in favour. Although I didn't go, I think that Download needs to expand its remit for the sake of the entire festival scene. There are some bands who should be welcomed in by the heavy metal community because they're heavy and they're exciting.
Yeah.
Don't necessarily play pure metal, you know. I don't think there's any room for that kind of elitism. And also, you have to ask yourself, I know you and I have had this conversation before, who are the next big bands that are going to take over? And I don't really see many, frankly, who are going to be the next Metallica and the next, you know, whatever, the next Slayer, the next Maiden. So if you want to bring people in who are from a related form of music, like Muse, I'm okay with that, you know. I mean, I think the organisers of these festivals know where how far they can't go. Didn't Download have chasing status a couple of years ago, the dubstep people?
Yeah.
That was roundly disliked, I think, by a lot of people. But it worked because they were on with the Prodigy that night.
Yeah.
But you kind of get in the back door, don't they, the Prodigy? You know, everyone likes them.
Who was it played? Was it Metallica played Glastonbury? And there was a lot of uproar over that.
God, is that just this year?
It's funny. No, I think it was last year, wasn't it?
It must have been.
Yeah.
It's funny, isn't it? You come to the end of the year and you think, fuck me, I've got a lot's happened this year. I got no problem with that. You know, a lot of artificial hype was sort of whipped up around that. It's a festival, you know. Metallica should play all the festivals while they can. That's what I say.
Yeah, and of course...
thing, and that the old Guns N' Roses reunion thing, that's been quite an interesting thing to witness happening. It looks like it's going to happen, in maybe not next year, but the year after.
Yeah, but it's not going to be all of them, I don't think.
Oh, really? I didn't know.
I heard, well, the rumours are it's Slash, Duff and Axl with two other guys. Stephen Adler is the one jumping up and down. He wants to be involved, and they're saying that it's not going to be Matt Sorum either. So, and you know...
Izzy doesn't want to do it?
I think Izzy has been dissing himself from that band since the early 90s.
Well, you know what? Duff, Slash and Axl is a pretty good start.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm not going to be, you know, rushing around the corner to buy my ticket to see him, but I am happy that they're doing it because so many people are interested in that stuff, and I'll be interested to see if they can recreate it. I mean, Duff is absolutely on his game. That guy is a machine. Slash, I think, is also easily capable of doing those old tunes the justice they deserve. Yeah. So I think it'll be an interesting spectacle. I mean, I wonder whether they'll make as much money as people predict. I don't know whether there is that much money around, frankly, but no, it'd be interesting to see that.
I think they're going to fall in that category of that concert goer that's like the AC/DC fan, that they don't go to any other concert any other time, but AC/DC comes around and they go, and they couldn't tell you about any other bands. There's an opening band, they've got no idea who they are, but I think GNR would be the same thing. Is they're just gonna, they'll sell out for that guy who goes to one concert a year, has no clue about any of the machinations behind it or whatever. He just goes.
Yeah, and they'll charge like 200 quid a ticket or something.
Yeah, and the thing is, I mean, you talk about the fact that definitely Duff is definitely on his game, and the same with Slash. Those guys have really, you know, never diminished, or when they have, they've gone, hey, we're starting to suck, let's get back in the game. But I think, you know, seeing some of the live performances from Axl that have been televised and things, I don't think that he's got anywhere near the vocal power that he used to have. So to me, he's the weak link.
Yeah, that's a standard thing, though, isn't it? I mean, vocalists, unless they're incredibly lucky, and Glenn Hughes is pretty much the only one I can think of, is the exception. Vocalists tend not to be able to sing as well or as high as they did in their prime.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just the nature of bodies wearing out. You know?
Well, it's also, I mean, if you talk about Glenn, I mean, Glenn's still in incredible shape, too. But you look at Axl, that dude's pretty heavy, and that weight's going down on his diaphragm, and that's going to affect your range.
Right, okay, yeah, you could do with losing a few. But as a guy who's carrying more than his fair share, I kind of appreciate that. But he...
That's okay, though. Bass players can get big. It's all right.
Yeah, it's expected of us. It's what we're supposed to do. Yeah. But no, it'll be interesting to see. I mean, he always had that funny voice, didn't he? He had two voices.
Yeah.
The Papa Bear one and then the Shriek. Yeah. And I will be interested to see how they do it, whether they have to tune down a couple of steps to accommodate that. But anyway, it'll be interesting to see if they're any good.
Yeah, there's two things that interest me about the Guns N' Roses thing. He can't pull the crap where he comes on 3 hours late. That's the first thing.
None of that. The industry will not stand for that anymore. I'm amazed they stood for it back then.
And the second thing is, will Axl make the rest of them play anything off Chinese Democracy?
I am in intense pain, Tinky.
Oh, man. The thing is, would anyone show up and want to hear those songs? So if I were Axl and his handlers, I would say, right, we play the whole of Appetite all the way through. And then we come back and we play, you know, the five songs that everybody knows from the rest of the career and do it like that. That's all people want to see.
Yeah.
And that's what they should do. And yeah, it'll be a shame actually if it's not Izzy and Steve as well. I would like the all five to be there. Yeah, I mean, I don't really care that much. I mean, I hope they do something interesting like that just because I want to see the industry react like that when a giant band comes back who always said they never would. Then again, I always thought Faith No More would never come back. I interviewed Billy Gould a bunch of times between the first and second careers of Faith No More, and I always used to say cheekily at the end of the interview, so any chance of reforming? And he'd always say, it's literally never going to happen. It's fucking never going to happen. Not because we hate each other, but we don't believe in repeating ourselves, which is legit, you know. And then I remember I got an email from him saying, yeah, you know what, it's kind of like 50% likely going to happen. And I'm like, what? And then 6 months later, they were back, and I'm glad they were back, because that is a band that I love. But yeah.
I had read an interview with the current guitarist. I can't even really call him the current because he's been there for a while. But the guy that replaced Jim.
John Hudson, yeah.
Thank you. And, you know, even he was, I guess, shocked when this latest reunion, he thought, yeah, definitely done. It was like, you're shitting me. Really? We're back?
He's great, actually. I mean, at first I was a bit like, oh, I'd love to see Jim. But, you know, then I spoke to them and realized that there's just not a relationship there. Mm-hmm. And John's an amazing guitar player. So, no, and I liked the stuff that they did with him as well, the last couple of albums.
Yeah. And I also like the fact that when they came back and they're doing these appearances, they did it in true Faith No More style, like with the all the white and the flowers. And like, who the hell does that? Only Faith No More does that.
Yeah. Just to kind of, and Mike Patton, well, I saw him play in London this year. And after like the fourth song, he sort of stopped the show and everyone was loving them. And he said to the crowd, you fucking assholes. For no reason at all, right? Because everyone was kind of, the vibe was really good. And he just does that, just fucking fuck with people. And everyone then started laughing and doing that thing where they shouted, you fat bastard, you know, that they always used to do back in the 80s, which was brilliant to see. He started laughing, the rest of the band started laughing. And what other singer will do that? Like, you come back like that and you're playing these big venues, you treasure that, right? And you want to say, oh, I love you and thanks for coming out and visiting us. But no, he doesn't. He insults them to their faces. And that is very, very Faith No More, as you say.
Yeah.
That was brilliant to see and a little bit shocking. I'm like, shit, you know, is there going to be a riot? But everyone loved it and just started laughing at him, which I really, and he laughed back. So that was great to see.
Yeah, so what's your take, Joel, on Sabbath announcing their farewell tour without Bill Ward playing drums?
Well, I think it's the right thing to do. You know, well, it's the right thing to do for them to retire, certainly.
Yeah.
If indeed they do. The thing with Bill is a shame. It's a real shame. I've seen them with Bill, of course, you know, obviously. He's amazing, that guy. And I like him as well. I've spoken to him a bunch of times. He was apparently unable to sign the contract for business reasons. You know, he obviously wasn't happy with it and was unable to compromise to the extent that their managers required. And that's as far as it, really. I mean, I think...
Sad. It's sad, Joel. It is sad because they're the four guys that started the band, you know, and they can't get it together to finish.
I know, but that's something that people should bear in mind. It's business, you know. I mean, Brad Wilk did a great job on the album. Tony Clufetos did an equally good job in the subsequent live dates. Maybe they need someone who's a bit more of a powerhouse behind the kit. You know, maybe they do. I hope they bring Bill out to play on a couple of songs when they encore or when they do the final gig. They probably won't, but you know, why should they please the audience? You know, why should they go against their principles just to make us happy? You know, and complete the tick all the boxes for us. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's not, and frankly, it's not like it's Iommi is not doing it and being replaced by another guitar player, is it? So, you know, I wish Bill were involved, but if he's not, fuck, I'm still going to enjoy the gig.
Yeah, yeah. You know, swinging back to books, and you know, you were asking about some of the books that we read this year. One that I read just recently, we had the author on just recently, was the book Van Halen Rising. And one of the reasons I like the book is it reminded me a lot of the way that you present bands as well. I don't know if you had a chance to read that book at all.
Is that by Ian Christie?
No, this is by a guy called Greg Renoff. It's his first trade book he's ever done.
Uh-huh.
It really delves into like the initial birth of Van Halen. So it's kind of got the parallel paths of the Van Halen brothers and David Lee Roth. And you really get this really good sense of what everybody brings to that band. And it goes right up through the tour for VH1 and ends. And like I said, it reminds me a lot of the way that you present bands as well.
Well, that's great to hear. In fact, I have been fairly biased in my time. I have always been very opinionated about what I think about the music of certain bands, possibly too much actually. But no, it's, I mean, he sounds like a good man. The book is good, right?
The book is very, very good. Right? And it really, I mean, they interview a lot of people that were involved with the band back in the day, or even, you know, friends and people that went to the backyard parties and all that. And I had asked Greg, I said, well, are you going to do a Van Halen 2 or, you know, and he says, no, he goes, it's probably going to be impossible because once you get past VH1 and that tour, then all the other people that are in that scene, like the hangers on and the insiders get smaller and smaller. And the pool of people I have to interview and get a story like shrinks dramatically from that point on.
You'll be willing to talk as well.
Exactly.
Suddenly goes way down. Yeah, it's interesting, and you know, that's probably the most interesting part of their career anyway, right?
Mm-hmm.
The early stuff. No, that's good. I'm glad there are people out there really, really doing their due diligence, you know, and getting the research done. On a related note, actually, I read Sammy Hagar's book not long ago, and I laughed my balls off, man. I mean, he literally throws them under the bus.
Yeah.
Times, then he, you know, which cracked me up. I know it's been out a couple of years now, but that was a book I really enjoyed. I wouldn't have the balls to do that in a book I wrote.
I think what amazes me, you bring up the Hagar book, Joel. In Hagar's book, he had to go in and re-record the vocals for the live record, and he did it all in one take and said, right, screw you, I'm out of the studio. And yet they bring out a live album this year with Rot, and it gets panned because they didn't do anything to his vocals.
You can't win, can you?
No.
You know? I mean, there are live albums, aren't there, famously, that have had everything redubbed, you know, back in the studio. And then there are bands there are albums which are not. And, you know, some people prefer it one way, some people prefer it the other. They should put out two versions, shouldn't they? It's kind of undoctored and doctored. But, yeah, I mean, that's good. I mean, Van Halen, that's an interesting band. I mean, what the hell are they going to do now? I interviewed Wolfgang not long ago for the Bass Mag. Seems like a young, keen young lad. Great bass player, actually.
Yeah, we talked to Mark Tremonti about him, because obviously he was, you know, playing in Tremonti, and Mark really raved about him and really appreciated like what Wolfie brought to the process. Because, you know, most people think, oh, it's just Eddie's son and he gets a pass and all that. But Mark just praised him up and down and really could pinpoint a lot of the contributions that he made to the album.
He has a lot of skill. You know, he's a great bass player, and regardless of who his father is, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I can't let you go, Joel, without asking, did you ever interview Scott Weiland?
No, I never did. I wish I had. He sounds like an interesting character. Yeah. I wrote an obit for him for the Telegraph here, the newspaper, which is coming out the next day or two, and spoke to a few people who had known him. And every single person said the same thing, which was that he was incredibly difficult to be with sometimes. And at other times, he was an absolute genius and a lovely guy to be around and, you know, and a good father and all this stuff. But that his demons just got the worst of him. And, you know, I don't think anybody was particularly surprised to see him go. Mm-hmm. But it's a very sad thing. You know, what can you say? I mean,
yeah.
I start to catch up with people, unfortunately. And it's happened to more people than we could name.
Right. Now, if memory serves, after all the events in Paris recently, didn't you write an opinion piece for the Telegraph on that?
So I did, yeah, the Sunday Telegraph. And what happened was I was taking my daughter, who is 12, to her first arena show, a couple of days after the Paris attacks. We went to see this band, Imagine Dragons, that I'm sure you've heard of.
Mm-hmm.
Huge band. I mean, massive. And she, you know, along with a lot of kids of her age, loves them. You know, they're kind of that pop rock sort of feel. And she'd never been to a big show. I'd never taken her to one. So I went and took her and her friend along. And the piece that I was asked to write was really discussing, well, how do I explain what happened in Paris to someone of that age? Does it make me think twice about taking her to a show of that size? Which, of course, it did. And what should we take from this? And that piece turned out quite well. They edited it sensitively, and there's a picture of us. They said, can you send a picture of you and your family? And I said, yeah, sure. What kind of picture do you want? And they said, well, send us a happy one and a somber one. And the picture they chose is the somber one of us all looking really pissed off, which is kind of funny. But the piece itself was interesting. And I haven't really talked about my family in print particularly. I never put pictures of them on Facebook and stuff. I've got two young children whose identities really should remain private until they're old enough. But so this was an exception, really. I talked about them in this newspaper.
Yeah, and that's what struck me at first was that we've never really talked with you about your family or anything. And I saw that picture and stuff, and I was shocked. And to me, knowing you, that transmitted to me like how much that piece meant to you. And I get that out just by seeing that picture.
Definitely. But I should also say that they're old enough now, so they're not babies. You know, they understand this kind of, they understand what terrorism is. And one of the things points I made in the piece is that we were able to have a discussion as any, you know, dad would, I guess, with kids of that age that is sensitive and is not particularly holding anything back. They understand the facts. What was reassuring, actually, was that the security, when I got to this venue, which was the Barclaycard Arena in Birmingham, the security was completely solid. I mean, they packed us all down, even the kids, who had to check in their bags. You know, the little 12-year-olds couldn't take their bags in, which I think is probably over the top, but the general ethos is a good thing. And but I do think that there's more of a risk at small club shows than these massive stadiums. So it's just a horrible situation, really. You know, and someone got stabbed on the London Underground today or yesterday by someone who claimed to be a terrorist. And things are hotting up a little bit. You obviously had that thing in was it San Bernardino?
Yeah.
Which was supposedly linked to some sort of terrorist cause. And so it's a strange time at the moment. It's not anything we haven't been through before. You guys will remember what it was like in Ireland in the 80s. And we used to get on the London Underground in fear and trembling quite a lot that time as well. And, terrorism is an awful thing, but it's not a huge global problem in terms of the people that it affects. You know, I mean, hundreds of thousands of people will die in third world countries yearly from largely preventable causes. And that is something which is on an enormous scale greater than the terrorist threats we face. That said, there is obviously an ethical thing going on with rock gigs being attacked, which hasn't really been done before. Kerry King talked about it the other day, didn't he? He said he was surprised it had taken the terrorists so long to hit gigs because they're such an expression of Western freedom. Yeah. Jumping around like a nutter listening to heavy metal, you know, is one of the, it's the sort of, it's one of the key things that we do in the West, don't we?
Yeah.
And it's not something that's subject to repression. And in fact, it's very much often a vehicle for protest, you know. So, yeah, it's a grim time. I think the threat will pass. I don't know if bombing the hell out of Syria is the right answer, frankly, but I don't think anyone knows what the right answer is. It's a bit of a nightmare, to be honest with you.
Yeah, Joel, just one final thing before we let you go. Yeah. I want to ask you about a picture you had on your Facebook page. You went down to where the Sabbath debut album was.
That was a day, man. So I told you about this band Akakoka, right?
Yes.
It was the guy with me, Jason Mendoza. He's a good friend of mine. It was weird is that I wrote this book about Sabbath 10 years ago, massive book, 175,000 words. It nearly killed me. I've been following Sabbath's career for years and years and years, and I'd never been to Maple Durham Mill, even though it's like an hour's drive from where I live. I'd never been. So for some reason, I think my family were going to be away for a week. Jason was at a loose end. We wanted to have go out for the day and then have some drinks in the evening. And I said, why don't we go to Maple Durham Mill? And so any of you guys, if you're ever near London, it'll probably take you about an hour and a half to get there from Heathrow, 2 hours from central London. You have to book a ticket, I think. Yeah, you book a ticket online, it's like £3 or something. It's not visited by very many people, really. And you drive up to the gate and you go through the gate and that mill is right in front of you. And it literally is the sleeve of that first Sabbath album. And your mind is blown instantly. And if you look at the actual sleeve, there's a tree partly obscuring the mill, or at least in the foreground where the mill is in the background. That's gone. So it's all a nice sort of grassy bank and you can get your photo taken. And that's what I did, and took that picture. And you can go inside and see the mill working. And it was also in The Eagle Has Landed, that mill. If you remember in that film, there's a scene when the guy gets killed on a water wheel.
Okay.
And that's there too. So you get all these Eagle Has Landed fans there, as well as all these headbangers walking around as well. It's hilarious. So anyway, if you ever get a chance to go there, please do, because it's an amazing place. And it blows your mind. You think, wow, here I am, you know, back in 1970.
Yeah. Nice. So Joel, what books have you got coming out next year besides the Thunder book? Or can you even tell us? Can you tell us about them?
I think if I can. there's Oh, yes, I can. There's one really cool one. It's the autobiography of John Mayall, the blues musician.
From yeah, it'd be interesting.
Oh, it's amazing. I mean, the stuff we've talked about. So he's now 82. It's a hell of a story to fit in. He is a man who's literally done everything, man. And so in the 70s, his house in, I think it was Laurel Canyon, which is in Hollywood, right?
Yeah.
Was called the Brain Damage Club. Because of the stuff that went on. And now he's sobered up and lives a responsible lifestyle. All the stuff that happened in the 70s, you would not believe it. I'll tell you this quick story before we go. In order to gain entry into what he called the Brain Damage Club, right, which was this group of fucking nutters, you had to do something crazy. And one of the things they did was jump off a third-story building into his pool, right, which was sort of below this giant drop from the top of the roof. And they used to do this on a regular basis. And he did it one day. And as he went to make his run up and his jump, he spotted someone was in the pool right where he was about to land. And that kind of made him hesitate, right? But it was too late to stop the jump. So he jumped, but he wasn't now jumping far enough to hit the water. And he hit the poolside. And his knee completely exploded into several pieces. Beneath the skin, his heel was so shattered it was shredded into tiny, tiny chips of bone inside his foot. And he fell into the pool and they took him to the hospital. Imagine the pain he was in. They wouldn't give him any pain relief for like a day and a half. And I think because he was off his face, probably, you know, they couldn't give him any pain relief because he was already on several substances. And anyway, that's just one of the things that happened. He still walks with a limp to this day. I can't imagine that. And anyway, so this story is packed full of this. So there's Thunder's book, which I'm about to finish in the next couple of months. There's Mayall's book, which will go into next year. There's a couple of other projects coming up, which I'll tell you about in due course. But basically, the autobiographies of well-known people. And editing Basic Guitar Magazine, doing journalism. So yeah, that's kind of keeps me busy. So it's all good.
What's happening, Joel, with the last time we talked to you, you were doing a book on guitars.
Was I indeed?
Yeah.
Guitars? What kind of guitars? I mean, was it? I think it might have been.
It was a guitar manufacturer that has four letters in the name.
It was Dean. Yeah, yes. Yeah, we can talk about that. Yeah, that might happen at some point. It's just on the back burner at the moment, right?
Yeah.
But because everyone's too busy to make it happen. But that's that will be a really good book whenever it happens.
Nice.
But at the moment, that's just one of those things that's going to happen when everyone can get around to it.
Nice. Yeah. It's great to end the year with the Joel MacGyver episode. You know, that was one of the things when Richie said, we're going to get Joel on. I'm like, that's our year end right there.
It's very much mutual. Thank you so much, guys. It's always great to talk to you.
Awesome. And hey, before you leave, just give everyone a shout out to know where they can find out all about what you're doing online.
Well, I've got a website, which is joelmaciver.co.uk. But actually, if you want to catch up with me on a sort of more immediate basis, check out my Facebook, which is facebook.com/joelmaciver, and my Twitter, which is just @joelmaciver.
That's right. Yeah. And you're always posting on Twitter. That's how I knew you did the Telegraph one, was that popped up early Sunday morning. It was like, oh, wow.
That's right. I'm actually not on Twitter as often as I should be. I should really be promoting the hell out of myself. But no doubt,
yeah,
I'm forced to do that more as time goes on. But anyway, that's where you can find me. So
awesome.
Get in touch.
Cool. Like I said, we appreciate the hell out of you taking so much time to talk to us again, Joel. And it's great to end the year with the Joel MacGyver episode.
Well, you know, when I talk to you guys, I feel like we're just sitting around in the pub talking about metal. So it's great, great fun. Thank you. That's it.
And I felt bad today. I got up this morning and I went, oh, shit. I meant to go pick up some Guinness. So at least Richie and I could drink Guinness while we were talking to you. And I totally spaced it.
That's a bit early here for Guinness.
It's a real bitter drink. I've got into it in the last few weeks. I'm going to be powering down that stuff next few months.
And it's supposed to be one of the most lowest calorie beers you can drink.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Like, it's kind of like drinking black soup, isn't it?
Yeah, but you get the hangover from hell if you have too much of a chill.
Yeah, man, I know. You got to. Unfortunately.
Yeah, you get a bad hangover, but you're tin.
I feel. All right, guys. Thanks.
All right, Joel. All right, Joel. Take care.
Yeah. All right. See you.
All right.
Bye. And for our final track of 2015, off of the Frostburn album, I give you Lords of the Trident with Winds of the Storm. And by the way, these guys have a Patreon campaign going on. You should go support them. That is at patreon.com. Search for Lords of the Trident and become a patron of the band and help them produce and continue to create more of this great Lords of the Trident music. And if you're not familiar with patreon.com, you should head over there. Anyways, check it out. It's a great way to support a lot of artists. But I mean, hey, as long as you go there and you check it out, just look up Lords of the Trident, check out what's up. And even for as little as $1 a month, you can support these guys and help them continue on their quest for world domination. Is everything in the world, Joel MacGyver. Hope you guys enjoyed that one as much as me and Richie did doing it. Definitely, as you can hopefully tell, we had a lot of fun.
Yep. Well, you get an hour with Joel, you shoot the shit.
Get a lot of shit in there.
You get a lot of shit in there. Yeah. A lot of music, a lot of other stuff as well. Some family stuff, current affairs. You know, the guy...
You didn't get any rugby in, though.
No. The thing I love talking to Joel about is, like, his phone... You brought it up in the interview. I'd say his address book and phone numbers, but it must be something else, because he's like, oh, I talk Kerry King, I've talked to all the Slayer guys, Paul Bostoff, all the Thunder guys, and you know, all these, he's probably spoken to the Metallica guys. Like that guy is like, that's normal to him.
Yeah.
You know, like
that's why I wanted to ask him about that, was because it is. I mean, whenever we go to do an interview or whatever, and I'm looking at the address book, and it's still like I go right back to the 17-year-old me who's looking at some guy's name going, like, the 17-year-old me would have never dreamed that I would have had, you know, guy X's like cell phone number.
Yeah.
You know, like, what the hell? And I'm glad Joel said what he said, because it is. I mean, it does hit you like, wow, this is like, it's kind of weird.
Yeah, it must be tough for guys like that. They have to separate the fanboy to the professional journalist. And they got to do a professional job without gushing in front of the guy. Like, if I met Tony Iommi or Eddie Van Halen,
you heard me do it with Shanker.
Yeah,
it's like, I went to fanboy mode with Shanker.
It's like Jimmy DeGrasso when we asked him about David Lee Roth. Had I ever met Roth? And I'm like, no. And I'm thinking, Christ, if I met Roth, I don't know what to say to him. Really? I've been fortunate this year. I've met a couple of guys like that. They wouldn't be up there with Hetfield and all these guys. Like, I met Michael Sweet this year. We've had him on the show.
Yeah.
Great guy. I met Kev Winger, great guy. We met Mark Tremonti.
Yeah.
Really nice guy.
Yeah.
We've been fortunate.
We almost got stepped on by Rudolf Schenker.
We met James Kotak. That was a fantastic night. Like, that guy is one of the nicest guys we've met since we started doing the show.
Yeah.
Like, just couldn't do enough for you.
Yeah.
An amazing guy.
It was like, stop, dude, stop.
Yeah. I'll get you a drink. There's no drink backstage. And James, stop. We're fine.
Yeah.
And we never even met him.
Yeah.
You know, just an amazing guy. So we've been very fortunate doing the show that we can get to meet some of these people. And so far, I have to say, none of them have been pricks.
No, everyone's been very cool.
So they're out there and we'll probably meet them eventually. But no, we've been cool. We've been lucky.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and, you know, Joel, I'm sure probably, you know, I'm sure he's met a lot more than we do. I'm sure some of them are probably very standoffish. And,
yeah.
But I'm sure he spoke about, you know, doing the Thunderbook, the great guys and all that. So, you know, doing a job like that, it comes with its hazards. You know, you don't know who you're going to meet. You might meet a guy at the wrong time of the day. You know, a professional journalist in music business, the musician might see what he does as a necessary evil.
Uh-huh.
And sometimes it must be tough for him, but, you know, he still seems to have the enthusiasm to do it. So, you know, more power to him.
Yeah, no, that does a great job with everything he does.
So he does.
I'm certainly glad that he's, you know, consider him to be a friend. So
he's a great guy.
Yeah, cool. So that is a wrap for 2015 for Focus on Metal, and I hope you guys enjoyed your year with us. We enjoyed bringing you another whole year of shows. I think the way the schedule is running right now is there. We go. I think the way the schedule is running right now is that at least probably the next week. We won't have a new show, be traveling, but I believe the week after that, that we will be back once again. So probably, like I said, probably a week off the first week of the year, and then we'll be kicking off 2016.
Yeah, we've got stuff, not scheduled, but on the offering table.
Yes, and we got to still have a whole bunch of Little Mountain Sound.
And we have to do the next Saxon episode.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Yeah, they keep putting out albums.
I'll keep bringing that up. And every 6 months, I'll keep bringing it up again. And then I'll bring it up again. And we'll get it done. But speaking of Saxon, you've got the deluxe version there.
Yeah, it finally came in.
Yeah.
I think I tweeted the day it finally came in. I was very happy.
Nice. So. Actually, I didn't like the cover. And now I'm looking at the vinyl, the size. And it looks really cool.
Big, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does.
Yeah. I mean, it's kind of like the one with Queensryche, right? You look at the CD and you're like, when we talked to Michael.
I couldn't make anything out. Yeah. You put it on the screen. I was like, oh, yeah.
Yeah.
That's the problem with CD covers now. You miss all that stuff and you kind of think that the bands don't really put as much effort in as they used to when they did covers.
Well, I mean, you got to think, right? I mean, if we were to talk to Martin about album covers, I think we did, didn't we? Did we talk to Martin about album covers?
No, but he had a book on them.
He did. Yeah, but you know the whole idea that, I mean, originally album covers were paintings or other artwork, and you know now you have most of these ones that are done real quick with Photoshop, and there aren't as many of these ones that are doing oil on canvas and all kinds of stuff anymore. So, yeah, I mean the whole thing has changed quite a bit.
Well, Will Reese, who did the Strange Highways cover, emailed me about that. He said literally the paint was drying when he was running in with it to get it, to make sure it was done to get the album out in time.
Yeah.
Now it's just copy paste.
Yeah.
Whatever they do on with the computer now to get it done.
You know, when you talk about artworks, this is classic Focus on Metal. Now we're going down a rabbit hole, and I'm sure you've read it too, and a lot, because we've read a lot of the same books over the course of the years. Is that they talk about a particular album and they talk about the cover, and they go, "Yeah, it was a real awesome painting," or whatever it was. gee, I wish I knew where it was. Like, where the hell did all these artwork disappear to? Is there like some, you know, Columbia or Capitol executive that's got some storage locker full of freaking artwork? It's amazing how with regularity people talk about this great piece of artwork that was delivered that it's disappeared. No one knows where it is.
Yeah, but
anymore.
Do you think with the artwork that the artist owns it or the record company owns it?
Well, if the record company paid the artist to do it, then the record company owns it.
Yeah, so God knows
the band, you know, and if the band didn't, if they didn't recoup from the band the cost of the album, then again, the record company owns it.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, there's been a few that, you know, guys have said, oh yeah, it's, you know, it's hanging in so-and-so's office still, that type of thing. But you got to wonder, where the hell did all these albums
go? Well, I remember a while back in classic rock, now I don't know if it's the original or not, but Biff was in his, was photographed in where he lives now.
Yeah.
And he had the Crusader painting behind him. Now, I don't know if what it is as regards originality or anything like that, but it looked pretty cool behind him.
Yeah.
You'd love to have some of those paintings, wouldn't
I
you?
I would,
oh
yes.
Oh my God.
Yep, I absolutely would. Yeah. 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 Cool. So anyways, like I said, that's a wrap for 2015. We've had a blast doing this for another year, and so far 2016 is definitely looking up as well with some more great stuff. So hope you guys stick with us. Any other final thoughts for the year, Richie?
Nope. Just have a few beers. Don't get too hungover. You got to go back to work.
Great. All right. Well, in the meantime, you know, keep up with us on focusonmetal.net, focusonmetal.blogspot.com. You can hit up Richie at facebook.com. And of course, you can follow everything going on Twitter. So that's it. That's a wrap for this year. And again, big thanks for Joel MacGyver for being such a great guy, such a good friend, and for coming on and helping us cap off the year. And definitely go up to joelmacgyver.com. Check out the books that he's got available. He's got links to get them from amazon.co.uk as well as amazon.com. So it's easy to get them. And good stuff there.
Yeah, definitely. Joel's books are really, really good.
Yep.
Very absolutely. Well researched and well written.
Yep. And you know, we also talked about with Joel, we talked a little bit about Martin, and Martin's also coming up with a lot of books. And in case you don't know it, you know, obviously we had him on about the Riot book. His Motley Crue coffee table book is out as well. And I would think that probably about the time you're listening to this episode, if you're not on Martin's mailing list, it will be on his website as a link. And about this time, you should also see the first volume of his new album book as well.
Yeah, well, Martin does the self-publishing thing.
Exactly.
He does it really well.
Yep.
You know, he's, I know one of the books he brought out, I'm nearly finished it now, it's probably over a year old, is a Megadeth book.
Uh-huh.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
The discography one. Really, right. Really good.
All right. So again, as we say it once again, that's a wrap for this episode and a wrap for 2015. Until we talk to you again next year, remember,
focus on metal.
Everything else is insignificant.
Still here? It's over. Go home.